Indeed presents hires you can't afford to get wrong, like payroll manager.
Hi, I was just checking my payslip and it's all in Japanese yen.
Yes, you're welcome.
Sorry?
Given the exchange rate between the pound and the yen, you're technically a millionaire now. Don't spend it all in one place.
I can't really spend it anywhere.
This is a job for sponsored jobs.
This is what happens when you don't sponsor your job on Indeed. So the next time you need someone to get the job done right, get matched with quality candidates with an Indeed sponsored job. Visit Indeed.com/next hire and sponsor your job today.
So what if the relationship that felt like your safe place slowly became the thing destroying your mental and physical health? Today, we're talking about covert narcissistic abuse, the kind that doesn't always leave bruises, but slowly makes you question your reality, your worth, and even your sanity. And sometimes the hardest part is that the relationship looks perfect from the outside. Welcome back to the show. Today's conversation is going to be deeply personal, emotional, and incredibly important. So our guest today is Sammy DeMarco. She is a survivor, a certified life coach, and someone using her story to help others feel less alone in theirs. So Sammy has lived through childhood trauma, religious abuse, sexual assault, grief, divorce, and most recently, the ending of a marriage that looked perfect from the outside, but slowly became emotionally devastating behind closed doors. Today, we're talking about covert narcissistic abuse, what it looks like, why it's so hard to recognize, how it impacts your mind and body, and how someone begins rebuilding themselves after losing who they were inside a relationship. So this conversation is about healing, truth, survival, and finding yourself again. Sammy, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me the opportunity to share today.
Yeah, your message is so important and so needed. Lots of people are going through what you went through. Man, before we even get into the marriage itself, can you share a little bit about your early life and the experiences that kind of shaped who you are?
Yeah, and you know, it ties into the married life because we kind of tend to repeat the cycles that we know in our lives. And so in my early childhood, I had a very, you know, toxic home. My dad, very narcissistic. My mom, very much like being controlled by him, put down kind of in the same situation. And I lived never feeling like I was enough. Like I always walked on eggshells in that household. You never knew like when my dad might explode. You never knew like what might happen. My parents were always fighting like behind their bedroom door. I could hear them fighting. And so like I was the kid that was always worried their parents would get divorced, and they did get divorced. And I ended up having just a tumultuous relationship with my father, like from the time that I was very young until I was older. He was always very critical of me. And I even remember at one point asking him, I had to be like 8 or 9 years old, like, Dad, how come you always tell me everything I'm doing wrong? Like, why don't you ever tell me something I'm doing right? And he's like, well, if I'm not telling you you're doing something wrong, just assume it's right. And so like I grew up very much with that mentality, and where when my mom and my grandmother would comfort me, my dad would say things like, you're just going to them because they tell you what you want to hear. You don't come to me because I am the only one that tells you the truth. So there was very much like a contentious relationship with him. And as a teenager, I actually didn't speak to him for years. He cut me off for probably a good like 2 or 3 years over a situation that happened where my mom came to pick me up from his house because I was having a hard time. And the police were involved because my mom didn't think my dad was going to let me go. And he ended up spending a night in jail and blamed that on me for the next few years of my life. So during that time, when I wasn't going to my father's house anymore every other weekend, I was very young, like 13, 14 years old. And I was starting to hang around with guys that were older. I would go to my mom's friend's house to babysit for her kids. And then there was an older group of guys that lived across the street from her. And it was like one of those like overnight babysitting, like kind of I'd go for a week in the summer and help her with the kids. And so at a very young age, 13, 14, I had these older guys that were 18, 19 years old, that what I now understand today as grooming, treating me like I was one of their own age, I got involved with one of the guys, and he ended up being somebody that was in and out of my life for 5 or 6 years from the time I was like 13 and he was 18. And I had no sexual experience, no like prior knowledge of anything like that. And I can remember like times that he was touching me and I didn't understand then like what that meant. You know, I understand like as a kid, like you kind of get the gist of like, ooh, this is first base, second base, third, like, you know, you learn those little things, but not like why that would be pleasurable, why that right. is something people would want to do, you know? So there was so much confusion that went around that as I got older, and I just became very much what people called boy crazy as a teenager, where there was always some kind of boy that I liked, that I was dating, that I was seeking out love from, that I was missing because I didn't have it from my dad, from which I really, you know, needed it. I was like, you're very stereotypical, like, you know, daddy issues, dad's not around. So I'm looking for love in, you know, different types of guys. And then I started going to church. And it's interesting because I started going to a church and I started to like pray and say, like, if only my dad, you know, believed in this, you know, in Jesus and this, then he would forgive me because I blame myself for everything that had happened still. And let me back in his life and he'll, you know, no longer hold all of this against me. And I didn't know at the time that my dad had started going to church. So when I found out, it was like this thing that is bonding us, that brings us closer together and everything. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that was going to become the first like major manipulation in my life, where at the end of my high school career, I was supposed to go to college in New York, but I didn't have enough money for the tuition. The student loans didn't come through. I didn't get enough of a scholarship. So I was left without any real school to go to. And I remember talking to my dad and like telling him that I didn't know what to do. And he said something to me along the lines of, you know, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're just going to get the same results. You need to do something different. You should come and live with me. And I didn't want to live with him. But at the time, he was also pushing me to go to court with him and testify against my mom, saying that she was letting us drink alcohol in the house. And like, in reality, as teenagers, my mom did like know that we were drinking in the basement, and she kind of like made sure that we didn't go anyplace and drove. And she was one of those like, I'd rather you be safe and be here. But it's not right. like she was supplying teenagers with alcohol or anything like that, which is what my dad basically wanted me to go to court and testify against my mom. And it caused all kinds of drama that put me in a situation where I was like, I can't stay living here. I can't go to court and testify against my mom and then stay living here. So I'm going to have to go live with my dad. And it turned out the judge didn't even want to hear me. The judge was like, you're insane if you're trying to bring your daughter into this courtroom and think yeah. that like I'm going to listen to anything that she has to say. But like the damage was already done. And so I was going and I was moving to live with him. And the Christianity became the center of everything. And in this particular denomination of Christianity, it was very much like leadership based, authoritarian based, where men are in charge, men are the leaders, women follow, and all of that type of stuff. And church was something that like you went to like 4 times a week, you know, you went to your Sunday school and you went on Mondays for prayer and Tuesdays for Bible study and Fridays for, you know, youth group. And very shortly into it, I met a guy there that, you know, I like fell for all quickly. And in the church, they just push you to get married very young. The whole thing is like, if you're going to end up having sex, then you might as well be married so you're not in sin, is basically right. like mindset of it. And so when we started dating, We were only dating, I was 19, we were dating for about 5 months before we got engaged. And I remember like feeling anxious before we got engaged. Like I had started going to a college in Pennsylvania nearby, a Christian one, but like I felt anxious. And my dad said to me, "You're just anxious because you're worried that what's going to happen, what happened with me and your mom is also going to happen to you. You know, you're going to miss out on this great opportunity to marry this wonderful Christian man that's going to be a pastor and who's going to do these great things, and you're going to let your anxiety get the best of you." So instead of listening to my body, I listened to my father and I got married. And that was one of the first times I can really remember my intuition was telling me I should not do something. And I right. did not listen to my intuition, went and got married anyway. And we moved to Texas to go to a Bible school there that was extremely culty, like very authoritative, very control based, lots of rules, lots of prophets and apostles that are like authorities that hear from God. And, you know, mental health was something that was looked at as like a demonic possession. So anytime I had struggles with my mental health, it was like, I didn't have enough faith. I just needed to pray more. I just needed, you know, to trust God more. I just needed to stop sinning, whatever the sin was that was in my life, I needed to stop doing. And it damn near destroyed my mental health. And part of the reason I was dealing with so much anxiety is because I have ADHD that went undiagnosed for most of my life. So I was dealing with all of these symptoms of ADHD and basically being told that I just don't have enough faith to quiet my anxiety, or that there has to be something that's sinful in my life that I need to get rid of, you know. And I ended up staying in that marriage for 5 years. We moved back from Texas to Pennsylvania to work for his parents' church. And once we were away from the school, it started to become a little bit easier for me to untangle from the idea that like I could never leave him, because in the church, you know, you don't have a valid reason to leave unless like they physically cheat on you or they're physically, you know, harming you. But meanwhile, the relationship was extremely toxic. He was one person when he was preaching on stage and another person when he was at home. He was screaming at me all the time, you know, like constantly snapping at me. And it's hard for me to fully remember everything from that time period because it just seems like so long ago. But I just remember like the constant fighting over stupid things. And I used to say to him all the time, "You're just like my father, you know, and like I married someone that's just like my dad." But looking back, I don't even know if it was that bad, because after I left that marriage and got into my second one, it was so much worse that like the first time around kind of seems like child's play, where it was a lot of arguing, a lot of unhealed, triggered people that could not get along in a relationship. I, at the time, believed that he was just like my dad and was like a narcissist. But quite frankly, we were 20 years old and 20 to 25 years old. I quite frankly don't really know if that's the case. I just know it was a toxic relationship. And I stayed in it because I felt the religious obligation to stay in it, despite the fact that felt like I was being treated badly, despite the fact that he also had an addiction to pornography, that it wasn't like something, oh, I just look at it once in a while. It was like a hours at a time per day type thing. And then expecting me to like not feel some type of way about my own body when you're trying to like, you know, put me into these like scenes that you've seen on a screen. Like, that's just so degrading. And I remember talking to someone about at the church about it, and it was just like, well, you need to like make yourself more sexually available for him so he doesn't. It was like that kind of really twisted mindset. And so I knew that I didn't love him or want to be with him. Once we moved to like Pennsylvania, I was like, I don't know what to do with myself. And my mom used to say to me, She's like, you know, one day you're going to get really, really tired of this and you're going to just be done and you're going to know you're done and you're going to call me and I'll be there and I'll come pick you up. And sure enough, like she was right. Like once I didn't feel hated by the church anymore to stay and things had gotten bad enough that I was like, if this is what God wants for me, then I just don't want anything to do with like God or the church anymore because this is absolutely miserable. And my mom helped me to get out of their relationship, to move to New Jersey, to start getting a fresh start, you know, someplace new. My ex came to New Jersey for like 4 months, 5 months, trying to see if we could like make it work one more time. Cause I was the type that was gonna do everything that I could. And ultimately, like, things fell apart. I found messages on Facebook that he was sending to another girl that he had met up with. And I have no idea what they actually did, but I just know the stuff that I saw. And it was like what I needed to just be like, okay, and feel good about it. And the biggest mistake I made then when I ended my first marriage is that I did not give myself time to heal because I didn't realize that I had stuff to heal from. Like I felt
yourself were
broken. So because I wasn't heartbroken over him, I didn't think that it was a big deal if I started dating right away, because to me there was no heartache, no grief over the relationship. I didn't realize there was a whole lot of stuff that had happened in that relationship that stripped a lot of pieces of who I was away from me that I needed time to like get back. I needed time to heal. I needed time outside that relationship, not only to heal from the stuff from the church, but from my childhood. Like I belonged nowhere near a new relationship. And I am very high empathy person. And, you know, I like very much feel for other people. And so when you're somebody that is extremely empathetic, you sometimes end up attracting narcissists. And I ended up in a new relationship fairly quickly.
And I want to ask you something. Right after, like when you started the new relationship, this one was one that felt so different to you though. Like this was so like... You felt like this one was like, my gosh, the world, the universe is finally giving me something really, really good. Like that's my interpretation of it.
Like I met my ex-husband and I felt like I met the man of my dreams. He was so handsome. Like, you know, he had a stable job and he seemed like he was very self-aware person. I was able to like talk about things that I had been through. He was able to share with me some of his feelings. And when we started dating, like he brought me on all these different kinds of adventures, to concerts, to different, you know, haunted houses. And these are all things that like he had access to free tickets to because he worked for a radio station that got those things. But they were also things that I loved doing. Like I love live music. I love going out and doing things that are, you know, things we can do together. And I started falling for him really fast. You know, it felt like our values really aligned. It felt like we had a lot of the same interests and the same desires for life. And at the time, I didn't know myself that well either. So I kind of thought I wanted to be like a little happy housewife and everything like that. And I was always like cooking and cleaning because that's what I thought I had to do. In reality, that stuff made me miserable. And I would learn later, you know, with ADHD burnout, that it wasn't something I was able to keep up with. But at the time, you know, we had this perfect relationship where it just seemed like everything clicked. We went on vacations together. Like he was my person. I could talk to him about anything. I'd tell him all the stuff that I had been through with my father, you know, and even the day we went to where he met my father the first time was for me to have like a really difficult conversation with my dad. And I remember after we left, my ex like hugged me in the car and he was just like, I'll never be like that. I would never do that to you. And I look back on that now and I'm like, he saw his own reflection in my dad that day. And he knew that he was going, he knew his patterns and relationships. Like he knew what he was going to do for me, but he, to me, but he kept it up the love bombing stage for so long and so well that I really didn't see the mask slip until after we got married. And I can look back and I see a couple little things, you know, after we got engaged that seem like those might have been little red flags, but there was nothing that you're like, oh my gosh, this man treats you horribly. Why would you marry him? Like, no, he treated me like gold. Like I had a fairy tale wedding. Like I had it, even today I tell people like my wedding day was still one of the happiest days of my life. Like despite what happened afterwards, like that day I was happy. I was marrying somebody who I thought was going to be the love of my life, my best friend that I was going to build this beautiful life with. I had my whole family there. It was a great celebration. My mom was still here. So like even when I look back to that day, I know that day I was the happiest that I really had. I've been happier now since then, but at that point it was like one of the happiest days of my life, and I still remember it that way despite what came afterwards.
So you mentioned that he's like a covert narcissist, and so what does that look like, and why is it so difficult to recognize compared to other forms of abuse?
So I feel like when it's a covert narcissist, and one of the things people don't realize about narcissists is that they're extremely insecure, and so they can prevent in two ways. An overt narcissist is the ones that you know, you think of all the time that like take up all the space in the room and like clearly everything is about me, 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 me. When it's a covert narcissist, that insecurity, it comes out in different ways where they will slightly put themselves, like he would put himself down and get me to build him up a little bit. And then I would start to notice that he would make little like snide like jokes that weren't really jokes, but were, you know, comments about things that I enjoyed that he would make, you know, these very like, what's the word, sarcastic like type comments that would build up over time. And with covert narcissism, you don't see it on the outside. It's always behind closed doors, and it's always the person that they are closest to that gets the worst of it. Because what they'll do is they'll start to isolate you and like do their own thing. They'll start to put down your family members in private and make you start to doubt whether or not you can trust in them. And little by little, he would start to put down and make comments about anything that I was interested in or I was passionate about. Even when it came to me, like we were talking one day about like women's rights issue, and I was telling him about a story that I had read. And he would always make really sarcastic comments where it's just like, oh, yeah, I'm a big fat feminist. I got to be all for women's rights and women's empowerment. And like just very like they'll make a lot of comments that make you wrong, but in really undermined, like really underhanded ways that are not as easy to detect. Like I got to the end of the relationship, there's specific instances that I can remember being out with him and his parents and having a conversation with his parents where we were talking about, you know, things that were going on. And it was at this point I was talking about the school that I'd went to. I was sharing some things and my ex was like, shh, like basically like stop talking. And that was something that was like a common thing that if I shared something, you know, it was like, stop sharing your opinion. I could be watching, we could be watching TV together and a story came on the news that I read something about earlier in the day. And I'm like, oh, I read this about, you know, this. And he'll be like, oh, you think you're such a know-it-all. You think you know everything. Like you always want to like, and I'm like, no, not really. And then he would say things like, you know, you're so lucky you have me to like worry about paying all the bills every month. Like, how would you manage to do all of that? And as I always struggled with anxiety. And after we got married, suddenly like my anxiety was a big issue for him. Whereas before we got married, it was very like understanding that I struggled with anxiety, that like, you know, certain things could calm me down. A hug could help me, you know, a little patience. But after we got married, everything like switched. And I remember he said to me one time, like, well, we're married now, so you're a reflection of me, you know, and like you have to like pull yourself together. And I started to realize that everything that he saw in me, basically that he didn't like, he felt like was a reflection of him. And he'd start to treat me like that. And it would be very subtle jabs until things would boil up, and then there'd be an explosion, because there's always eventually an explosion. And you wouldn't expect these type of people to be ones that scream and yell, you know, at their loved ones. Like, these are people that are calm and measured during the day at work. And there's times where I would say to my ex, like, if you just spoke to your boss the way you spoke to me, like, you would be fired. You know, like, there, you would not have a job right now. And it would be an explosion. And then after the explosion, the next day would be like a big apology. And then the love bombing would start again. Then it would be the little jabs in between, the cutting down the things that I was doing. When I started training to become a life coach and I wanted to like show him the binder I put together for my classes, like, he started a fight with me. He's like, why are you bothering me with that? Like, why are you bringing that to me? It's like, because you're right. My husband, this is what I'm learning. I just wanted to share with you. And it was only about 4 months in, and I know this because I have the recordings, that I started to feel so confused in the relationship, where he would tell me that I was causing, you know, these fights, that I was causing him to blow up. And I was terrified of losing him. I was like, oh my God, what am I doing to destroy this perfect life that I thought I was about to have? Like, everything was perfect. Why is it not perfect anymore? Like, what am I doing wrong? And I remember I started recording conversations on my phone so that I can listen to them back and figure out what I was doing wrong so that I could fix it. And that was like a good first sign that things are like not really the best, when you start to question your own sanity, that you have to record conversations to listen to them back. And I remember I would start listening to him back and I would think, okay, wait, no, like I didn't say that. I didn't do that. Like, he really did blow up out of nowhere. And at first I really like pushed back on him, you know, the way that he was speaking to me. I was like, this isn't right. Like, you shouldn't be speaking to me this way. But they wear you down over time. Mm-hmm. In the middle of all of this, my mom got very sick. And, you know, that's something that I'll definitely go into details about more, like, in a further episode. But my mom got very sick with liver disease. I was her power of attorney. So there was many times that I was being called to make decisions at the hospital. There were many times that she was fighting for her life before we ultimately lost her. And my ex made things a nightmare for me, like, just constantly complaining about the fact that I'm not home, complaining about the dishes not being done, complaining about trivial things where I'm like, my mom's fighting for her life right now. Like, how do you not see that that's what matters? And I remember him saying to me, like, well, I just feel a little resentful because it's like our life is on hold while she's sick. And it's like, whose life is on hold? Like, my life is still going on and it's a nightmare right now, you know? But because we weren't focused on him and what he wanted us to be doing in life and finding a house and building that picture perfect family, because that's what a narcissist needs, is that picture of perfection. You know, they need the world to see that they've succeeded, you know. And to him, success was the house and the family and everything else. And so the fact that we weren't focused on getting a house or doing any of those things because my mom was fighting for her life was an issue for him. And then the biggest thing that came up, and probably the craziest thing that my ex and I fought about and fought about most often, was the Backstreet Boys. If you notice, like, I have pictures behind me. Absolutely. I love the Backstreet Boys. I love 90s like nostalgia. It brings out so much joy in me. It's something that I've loved since childhood. And as an adult, like, I love going to concerts and getting with seats as close as I can. I've gone to VIPs, and this is things I did before I met him. I went to a Backstreet Boys concert in Vegas for my bachelorette party, and I remember him saying to me, like, oh, have fun saying bye to your boyfriend. And like, I thought it was a joke. It was not a joke. When my mom was sick in the hospital and the Backstreet Boys announced a tour and my friend and I bought tickets, and my mom bought my ticket. She was like, I want you to have something fun to look forward to. He made my life a living hell over going to a Backstreet Boys concert. If I bought tickets, there was a huge fight. Before the concert, there was a huge fight. After the concert, there was a huge fight. I had to fight for my own joy in that relationship, because my joy was a threat to him. And I started to realize that became a common theme throughout the relationship, is when I...
Well, not only your joy, but he was so jealous of like anybody else that you gave attention to. So narcissists are so jealous of everybody.
He was constantly jealous, and he'll tell you that he wasn't. He'll be like, I never was. I never stopped her from doing anything. And it's like, you may not have physically kept me from going and doing something, but you made me pay for it. And some people would say, like, well, why did you just like not go to the concert? And it's like, because that concert was 2 hours where I felt like myself, where I felt free, where I felt like, okay, I have a little bit of joy. And then I would go back home and I would be suffocated again. And I wouldn't feel like myself. And me going and doing things that brought me joy, like going to concerts or going to 90s conventions, those are like the two big things that I like to do a couple times a year. Those became the biggest fights in our relationship. Him telling me that my priorities were out of whack, that how can I say that I want to be a wife and mom, and then this is what I'm out doing. Like, what am I going to do when we have kids? And I'm like, adjust my schedule and not do the same things. But like right now, we don't have kids. And so like, I'm trying to have a little bit of fun. Life is really, really hard right now. So if you can do something to choose to have some fun, that's good thing, you know. But he was threatened by anything that brought me joy. Even when I'd go out with my sisters and we'd have like a sister's night out, if we weren't fighting before, he was sending me text messages and we were fighting about something, or we were fighting after. It was like I could not enjoy something without him. And I couldn't really enjoy anything with him either, because there were times we'd go to things together. Like, he went to a Mariah Carey concert with me around Christmas time, and he sat there like miserable the whole time. And I was like, okay, like, this is fun, you know? So even like the one time that he did go with me, it was like, he won't even participate in anything joyful with me. So it wasn't about that. I mean, he is a very insecure person, and someone who was miserable with himself and needs others to be miserable around him, because that joy was a threat to him. I remember when I started doing my coaching training, I didn't catch it back then. I see it now, but he was very resistant to it. And one of the things he said was like, well, what are you going to do? Like, go and be a life coach, and then you're just like married to this piece of shit. Like, obviously, like, I just think like you're going to outgrow me, and I don't want like that to end up happening, and for like you to leave me. And so there was so much that was meant to try and keep me small and keep me from letting any kind of light shine, because he was threatened by that.
So eventually you made the incredibly difficult decision to leave that relationship and start over in Florida. So what was that like? Was that terrifying for you?
It was absolutely terrifying. When I made that decision, I had reached a breaking point that I'll talk a little bit more about in depth in another episode. But I had reached a breaking point. Things were getting dangerous. He had started saying things that were scaring me, where he was making threats to his own life in ways that would have been taking his life in front of me, and made me like really fearful for how unstable like his mindset was at the time. So I was involved with the local, you know, battered women's services, and had that support there with me to kind of help guide me through that circumstance. But when I decided to move to Florida, it was because I wanted to start fresh someplace in the sunshine, and I wanted to be away from all the things that had broken me. And honestly, New Jersey was so expensive. I just couldn't afford to stay in New Jersey on my own. So on a whim, I looked up places in Florida where my best friend lived, and I was like, wow, this is like a third of the price of New Jersey, and it's in the sunshine by the beach. Like, this sounds like it's right. The right next place for me. So I remember I was absolutely terrified. But I was also very sure that this was the right next step for me. And when I started driving, it was at like 9:30 p.m. at night to drive through the night. And I remember I felt both terrified and incredibly brave and strong at the same time. I was like, I'm finally doing something myself. I'm finally.
So did you leave without telling him, or did
you end the relationship?
Okay.
Yeah, I had filed for divorce and had to actually live in the house with him for a few months before I was able to live out while the divorce was going on. And that was an absolute nightmare that resulted in me actually admitting myself inpatient for about a week when I was still there, because my mental health had taken such a turn during that time that I got so sick. I was like, I need other people to come in and start taking care of me, because I can't eat, I can't sleep, I can't function. The stress is really getting to the best of me. So I actually did an intensive outpatient program after that, along with the, you know, battered women's services, so that while I was still living in the house, I had that extra support. So when I finally got an apartment and a place to live, I moved within a week. Like, I packed everything as soon as I signed the lease. And I drove to the Florida in the middle of the night, 15 hours straight with just my pup. And I remember when I got into my apartment, I felt so much peace, like I was finally home. And I did all of the, you know, unpacking. I got to, because my ex didn't want me to take any furniture from the house, and I was fine with that, I had to buy all new furniture. So I decided to make this space my own. I was like, I want this apartment to feel like Sammy when you walk in. So my space is pink. I have pink decorations everywhere. I have a pink couch. I'm sitting on a pink chair. I'm always wearing pink. I absolutely love pink. I was like, it's going to be pink everywhere, because I want my space to feel like me. And I created that safe space for myself.
Good for you.
Then what I started doing was honestly what I pictured myself doing when I said I wanted to heal in the sunshine. I had already previously, when I came down to look at apartments, I also established care with like mental health providers to make sure that I had that support when I moved here. So I did a 2-week IOP program here in Florida, and really like had that extra support for 2 weeks to get myself going here. And then I spent honestly like hours a day in the sunshine, reading, journaling, digging in deep into like a lot of my old wounds, and then really rediscovering like who I am, the things that I love, like being loud and proud about the fact that I love my boy bands and I'm going to go to my concert, and it's like a part of my personality. And I made it so much so that like I could just be okay being me, where I'm just like, this is me. Like, I love the Backstreet Boys. I love Pink. Like, I love the things that I do. And the people that have a problem with that are not my people. The people that don't have a problem with it are my people. And little by little, I just started to rebuild this confidence in myself. So much so that I decided I was going to start auditioning for some TV shows and for some game shows. And I actually got myself on a game show on ABC by being completely myself. Showing up on as my bubbly personality, talking about how much I love the Backstreet Boys. And I ended up on TV on ABC on a show called The Greatest Average American. And like, I won.
Nice. That's so amazing.
Like, it was really amazing. Like, I went from so broken when I left New Jersey. And I posted a video the other day, because I actually recorded a video before I left New Jersey of starting my drive to Florida. And you can just see that everything had been drained from me, you know,
right.
There was no light left in me. Like I was just completely broken. The one thing that I'm so grateful that I did was spend as much time in solitude as I did. You know, I had one friend here who has a family, so I see her like once a month, you know, and otherwise I spent so much time getting to know myself and building routines that work for myself and doing things for myself in ways that help my ADHD brain, where I can take certain shortcuts that my ex wouldn't let me take. You know, like I use Instacart now because I don't like going to the grocery store. Like that is not something I would have been allowed to do in my marriage. Like, God forbid I paid somebody to do something that I could go do myself, you know?
Right. You know, what I find so interesting, though, is that before all of this, you were looking for someone else to complete you, like looking for validation from another human being. But then when you finally realized that you were better than that, you needed to get out of that, then you discovered that the only person that could truly make you happy is yourself. And so coming from that place is what most people never realize. Most people are stuck in these cycles that they think it's somebody else that's going to fulfill their life, when really it's their themselves that need to do that. So
yeah, nobody knows you better than you know you. Like nobody knows your needs better than you do. Nobody knows your body. Nobody knows your mind, your feelings, or anything like that. And so you know how to best love yourself. You know what you need. And I've stopped apologizing for doing what I need to do for myself. I've stopped asking permission. Like, I'm the only person I need to be accountable to. And like, this is now my life. I make the rules, you know, and I treat myself like someone that I love. And it's true. I spent my whole life looking for love outside of me, and spending time, I found it right within myself and realized I could provide all of that to myself. And that's how I know I won't get stuck in another toxic relationship, because I'm no longer looking for something to fulfill this need that I thought I had. I already fulfilled that in myself now. Like, it's going to take a lot for someone to penetrate in here and, like, you know, make me want to like give up my single life, because now I've gotten to a point where I'm like, I used to never want to be alone. And now I'm like, oh my God, I love being alone so much. Like, I can never imagine being with somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love for you to talk to the audience. What would you say to someone right now who's listening, who might feel trapped, or perhaps they're confused or emotionally exhausted in their own relationship right now?
I would say, if you are confused and emotionally exhausted in your relationship, that's not normal and it's not healthy. Like, I thought for a really long time that that's just how relationships were, that all relationships are hard. But just because all relationships are hard doesn't mean that they need to be confusing, doesn't mean they should be exhausting or painful. And I think the most important thing is to, one, like, acknowledge that this is what is happening, and that, like, your partner is the one that is causing harm to you in this relationship. Two, make sure you have a solid support system, because if you're feeling this way, then you're probably thinking, okay, I have like two choices. I have to stay here and endure this, or I have to leave, because I hate to break it to you, but like option number three, he'll change, is very, 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 very rare. So like, it's, to me, not an option. The option is, if this is happening to you, it's important to start making a plan to get out. Like, it's simple as that. Just because there's not physical abuse involved doesn't mean it's not having a physical effect on you. Like, my relationship made me physically sick. I had stomach issues all the time, headaches all the time, fatigue, muscle pain. I don't have any of that now. And I know if I stayed in that relationship that I would stay being sick all the time, that I would probably have some kind of chronic illness by the time I was 50. Like, I knew that relationship was physically killing me. So it's important to recognize that this is not healthy, and I do need to get out, and to get a support system to get out, because it's very difficult to leave a situation like that. You need somebody that understands what is happening to you and, you know, doesn't downplay any of that and can help you make a plan to leave. Because the best thing for me was that I had a plan. You know, I had a plan for myself, even though I got up and moved within a week's time. I had gone to Florida, you know, months prior to that and looked at apartments. I had gone and worked from Florida for 2 weeks to see, you know, if I enjoyed doing that. I set up my mental health care providers. Like, I had a plan so that as soon as an apartment opened up at the right time, I knew that, okay, now it's time to enact the plan and I can do that. But right. I think it's important to have a plan, especially at this stage, because the thing with abuse is that a lot of times it doesn't become physical because they're able to control you with their words and their actions, that they don't mm-hmm. need to physically lay a hand on you to control you. But that doesn't mean that it won't escalate to that. Because at the end of my relationship, my ex was making threats when I said I was going to call the police because he was harassing me. He told me he would run outside with a knife in his hand and let the police shoot him in front of me. And it was just like threats to traumatize me to where I realized, okay, he's getting more dangerous. You know, this okay. is not a safe environment. Like, he may not have ever hit me, but he'd drive 100, 120 miles an hour while screaming at me in the car. Like, that's terrifying, you know?
That's terrifying. Yeah.
So you want to make sure that you have a support system and you want to make sure you have a plan and also have an emergency plan, you know, like start making a plan for yourself, but also always know like someplace that you'll go if, God forbid, things escalate and things become physical, that you know you have a place to go immediately and you don't have to stay there and wait for it to get worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just want to like thank you so much for coming on here and being so brave and sharing the beginning of your story. I know you're going to be with us for a little while here sharing more of your story and breaking everything down into further episodes. And if listeners could remember one thing from your story, what would you like that to be?
I would say just that it's possible to get out of survival mode and to start to build the life where you thrive. I lived most of my life in survival mode where I was just surviving one thing after the other. And when I finally took control of my own life and decided that I was going to build the life that I wanted, that's when I was able to come out of that survival mode and realize that all of the things that had happened to me, that I didn't deserve those things, that they mm-hmm. weren't about me. And I was able to rebuild my identity. And then just also, I would love for people to remember that you don't deserve what's happening to you. Like, if you're in a relationship that's causing confusion, that's making you look up, why is my partner behaving this way, or Googling narcissistic abuse, or you're Googling, is this abuse? Chances are it is, because in healthy relationships, you're not wondering, is this abusive what they're doing? Like, you don't have to wonder that in a healthy relationship.
Right, right. Well, again, thank you so much for being here today. Tell everyone about the work that you're doing and where people can find you to follow you, and about your book and your coaching program.
Yeah. So hopefully my book will be out at the end of the year. It's actually going to be a 2-part series. The first part, Surviving, and then the second part on Thriving. And then I've also just launched a coaching program specifically for women who are, whether it's getting divorced, have been divorced, or thinking about getting divorced. I've launched a program to really help women like rebuild their lives. Rediscover who they are, get to know that inner critic and silence some of that like doubt that's going through them, and then really help them to build a life based on their own values, their own personal preferences, their own needs in their life. My goal is to help women build the life that they love. You know, I feel like I've built a life for myself that I absolutely love, and building a life for yourself that you love, it looks different to everyone else. But you can catch me at SammyRose1010 on Instagram and on TikTok. And then I'm under Samantha DeMarco on LinkedIn. You can connect with me on there and connect with me on Facebook. But I would be happy to talk to anybody. Like, if you're going through something and you just need someone to bounce off of, you know, a quick like strategy session of like, what can I possibly do next? Reach out to me and let's talk.
Amazing. Thanks again, Sammy, for being here and for sharing your story. It was so amazing. And I know that the right people are going to hear it and they're going to get so much inspiration from it. Because when you're in like the depths of the trauma, you don't really see a way out. there's a little glimmer of hope. And so my hope is that people hear your message today and that it gives them a little bit of a boost, just that confidence boost that I can do it too. If she can do it, I can do it too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was a miserable person for most of my life. And if I can pull myself out of that, anybody can, I promise you.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for our audience for tuning in and for listening to the show. So today's conversation with Sammy DeMarco reminds us that emotional abuse doesn't always look super loud, obvious, or dramatic. Sometimes it looks like confusion, self-doubt, isolation, walking on eggshells, and Googling, is this behavior abuse, when you're slowly losing yourself, trying harder and harder and harder to be loved. So Sammy's story is also about something else. It's about survival, healing, starting over, and rediscovering joy after pain. And maybe that's the message that somebody here listening needs to hear today. So you're not weak for staying. You're not broken for leaving. So to learn more about Sammy and her work, we'll have her Instagram and her TikTok and her website in the show notes. And if this episode helped you feel seen, understood, or feel less alone, please follow us at The Advisor with Stacey Chalemi. Subscribe on YouTube, leave a comment, send it to a friend, and we'll be sure to get back to you with any questions you might have. Take care, you guys, and we'll see you soon. Bye for now.